Det lå på Frederikshavn Lokalradio, bringer her den første af alt 5 juridiske forelæsninger under temaet Folkeretten og det nye forbud mod atomvåben. Hvad betyder det, og hvilken virkning vil det få? Og på selvlært engelsk. A new treaty prohibiting nuclear weapons, content and possible effects. Vi skal nu høre den første forelæsning. Vi nu listen to the first lecture in English. Nuclear weapons under international law 1949 to 2017. An overview. Folkeretlige reguleringer af atomvåben 1949 til 2017. En oversigt. Foredragsholder er lecturer is Dr. Jur Grå Nystuen, co-editor and author of Nuclear Weapons Under International Law, Cambridge University Press, 2014, in English. Forelæsningen blev optaget i Oslo den 11. december 2017 i forbindelse med fejren af at ICAN International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons fik prisen for sit mangeårige aktive bidrag til processen, som førte frem til en konvention, som forbyder atomvåben, som blev vedtaget af 122 FN-lande i sommeren 2017.
My name is Vidar Berglund, and I'm the chair of the No to Nuclear Weapons Norway Oslo branch, a member of both the Jurist Union and the Norwegian Lawyer Association that jointly run USE. I will try my best to guide you through you all through today's seminar. I heartily welcome all participants and lecturers here today in the Norwegian Red Cross headquarters. This seminar has been organized by USE, the Norwegian Center for Continuing Legal Education. That's a cooperation between the Norwegian Lawyer Association and the Jurist Union. No to Nuclear Weapons, Norway, and the Norwegian Red Cross. It is fitting that the venue for this seminar on the latest development in IHL is named after Henri Dunant, the founding father of international humanitarian law. In 1859, while traveling through the war-torn area of Lombardy in northern Italy, Dunant stumbled upon the Solferino battlefield at the eve of the largest battle in Europe since the Battle of Leipzig in 1813. Strewn on the battlefield were 23,000 wounded, dying, and dead soldiers, left there with little attempt to provide care. Dunant organized the civilian population in the neighboring city of Castiglione to provide assistance to the injured and sick soldiers, purchase needed materials, and help erect makeshift hospitals. He convinced the local population to service the wounded without regard to their side in the conflict, as per the slogan, Tutti Fratelli, all are brothers, coined by the woman of the nearby city of Castiglione della Stiviere. Back in Switzerland, Dunant wrote a book on his memories of Solferino, and went on to set up the Red Cross movement, which led to the adoption of the first Geneva Convention. Dunant was the first true ICAN campaigner, and also the very first recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, awarded to Dunant here in Oslo for the very first time in 1901. A special thanks to all the people that have assisted in realizing today's special seminar on the legal implications and the process that led to the nuclear ban. This seminar will hopefully be taped. I'm trying my best and will eventually then be made available for late review on a number of websites. I first want to thank USE, the Center for Continuing Legal Education, I think the whole world needs something like that, for financing and making this seminar part of their educational program for Norwegian lawyers and jurists. A special word of thanks also goes out to Erik Rau in USE for his commitment and perseverance with the ever-changing program of today's seminar. I also want to thank Greta Östern from the Norwegian People's Aid and ICAN and Mats Harlem in the Norwegian Red Cross for their help in securing the seminar's outstanding speakers today. I also want to thank the Norwegian Red Cross for providing the venue free of charge and for spreading the message of this event to their broad network here in Norway. However, without the guidance and scholarly direction provided by Norway's guiding star in IHL, Gro Nystuen, this seminar would not have materialized. The first lecture of today's seminar was personally one of the scholarly foundation stones for the development of the humanitarian argumentation, contributing to the springboard for the ICAN movement. This happened at the outset of ICAN's nuclear ban-related events that led the movement from Oslo through Mexico, Vienna, and New York to the nuclear treaty this July, which ultimately led to the Nobel Peace Prize and today's event. Dr. Juris Gro Nystuen, co-editor and co-author of Nuclear Weapons Under International Law, Cambridge University Press 2014, has worked on international humanitarian law issues in many positions and roles, always with a strong sense of commitment to the cause of peace and disarmament. In today's first session, the theme will be Nuclear Weapons Under International Law, 1949-2017, an overview. The challenge for our adversaries has always been that atomic bombs were never okay. Correct? Gro, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. And I know that we are already 5 minutes behind, so if you permit me, I will probably go on for 5 minutes longer, because to give an overview of international law concerning nuclear weapons in this time is quite challenging. So this is a mixed group, and parts of what I will say may be elementary to some of you, so I apologize to you, but I have to go through some of the fundamental stuff. In the discussions leading up to the new prohibition treaty, there has been a lot of talk about a legal gap and with regard to nuclear weapons. But this doesn't mean that nuclear weapons were not regulated under international law. And in this lecture, I will place nuclear weapons in the context of international law and its different frameworks. And as Vidar said, we published this book a couple of years ago, which is called Nuclear Weapons Under International Laws. And most of the topics I'll go through will be debated in more detail in this book. Okay. First, in order to make all of you understand what I'm talking about, I have to talk a little bit about how exactly international law is created. What is international law? Well, international law is the law between states, all of the law that exists between states. And because all states are sovereign, all states are also formally equal. And that means that in order to make law, states have to agree. That's very annoying sometimes, but that's how it is. So everything in international law is based on agreements, either treaties, conventions, pacts, etc. It doesn't matter what it's called. And therefore, yes, that is really how international law looks. And it's normally a two-step process. The first one is that states get together and agree on a treaty. And then the second step is that each state has to go back home and decide whether or not to join that treaty and be bound by it. And if it's not bound by it, then it doesn't apply. The sources of international law, therefore, according to the statute of the International Court of Justice, are treaties and conventions, which is the main source, and also customary law. And then secondary sources are judicial practice, jurisprudence, and also legal academic literature. And so this is a much shorter list of sources of law than national lawyers would normally use. For example, preparatory work is not a significant source under international law, and that is because it's very difficult to talk about the will of the legislator if you have 120 legislators. So you might get very ambiguous language for the purpose of coming to an agreement where states actually put different meanings into the same wording. All right, so if we look at international legal frameworks that are relevant to nuclear weapons, there are quite many of them. Of course, international law in general regulates all sorts of other issues as well, like airspace or postal services. We're not going to go into that now, but these are maybe the main legal frameworks relevant to nuclear weapons. And I'm going to go through some of them. I'm going to go through jus ad bellum and jus in bello very briefly. I'm not going to go through environmental law because it's a big issue. The same with international health regulations. I'm going to look briefly at international criminal law, international human rights law, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more about international disarmament law and also about regional defense alliances and nuclear umbrellas, because those are the legal frameworks which have been discussed the most in the context of the new treaty, at least by the skeptics. All right, so the law on war has two branches. One is what we call jus ad bellum. This is the law on justification of the use of military force against states. And its main rule is laid down in the UN Charter, and it essentially says you cannot use force, military force, or even threats of military force against other states. It's prohibited. But there are two exceptions. One is self-defense, and the other is when the Security Council has given authorization. This specific rule under international law does not say anything about specific weapons. So nuclear attack is prohibited to the extent that military attacks are prohibited in general. Now, having said that, there is a lot to say about this branch of law and nuclear weapons. And again, then I would recommend the book. We have written extensively about it, but there is no time to go into that here. The next area is the law on war. Within the law on war is what's called jus in bello, which are the rules applying to how to conduct warfare, irrespective of whether the war was justified or not. So the point of departure for this branch of law is that shit happens, and what do we do when it does? So it's the legal regime which paradoxically regulates what is normally very much prohibited and morally condemned. It's the law regulating killings and devastation. But these are the rules on what can be done to avoid humanitarian suffering and unnecessary escalation of the conflict when the war is going on. And the main sources in this area are the four Geneva Conventions from 1949 and their two additional protocols. And then we have a lot of treaties on specific weapons and another very important source, international customary law. So this body of law is called International Humanitarian Law, the abbreviation IHL. And this body of law implicitly prohibits the use of specific weapons. And these are the main rules. There is the rule on distinction. Everyone has to distinguish between combatants and civilians, and you cannot attack civilians specifically. It's the rule of proportionality on excessive injury to civilians, and the rule on superfluous injury and unnecessary suffering to combatants. And then there is a rule on comprehensive damage to the environment. I will not go into these because this is the subject of Lou Maresca's from ICRC's lecture later on. So I'll just skip them, but they are important to have in the back of your heads. Now, these two bodies of law that I've just mentioned, the first one, when is it legal to go to war, and the second one, what rules apply when the war is actually a fact, they are two separate legal regimes, and they must be kept separate. However, in 1996, the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, came up with an advisory opinion on the legality of nuclear weapons. And in this advisory opinion, they came up with a statement, which was the key statement of the opinion, which said two things. First, it said that the use of nuclear weapons would normally be prohibited under international law, but then it said, however, whether the court cannot conclude definitely whether the threat or use of nuclear weapons would be lawful in extreme circumstance of self-defense, in which the very survival of the state would be at stake. And this is a very significant statement, because it has taken to mean a different things legally speaking. Now, very many from civil society claimed at the time that this means that the ICJ prohibited nuclear weapons, whereas others, such as the nuclear weapon states, claim that the ICJ explicitly says that it would be legal to use nuclear weapons if the survival of the state was at stake, which is, of course, often the case in a war situation. So I think this was a very damaging statement. It confused the debate for many years. It also confused the debate on the nuclear weapon prohibition, because many people said, well, they are already prohibited. Well, to that one could say that this is only an advisory opinion. It is not hard law. The ICJ does not have the competence to make hard law. And I think it made a very unfortunate conflation between these two bodies of law here. Because if you can disregard IHL in extreme circumstances of self-defense, then IHL cannot really exist. All right, so the next area is international criminal law. It's another field which is relevant to nuclear weapons. But the ICC, the International Criminal Court, does not have jurisdiction to convict persons for the use of nuclear weapons. And that is because the ICC has a very limited jurisdiction with regard to weapons in general. Article 8 in the statute refers to an annex to be negotiated, but this has not materialized. And this was a very sensitive issue during the negotiations, because the ICC was based on what was assumed to be customary law. And it was very difficult to get states to agree to what is customary law with regard to weapons at all. So the ICC cannot actually convict persons for war crimes if they used nuclear weapons as such. But it's clear that the use of nuclear weapons, of course, would constitute war crimes or crimes against humanity, and could obviously constitute grounds for prosecution in national jurisdictions. International human rights law is also a very relevant legal regime. First of all, because international human rights law apply in armed conflict. And it's easy to think that an attack with nuclear weapons could generate human rights responsibility if a nuclear attack was not a lawful act of war. And of course, that is difficult to imagine how a nuclear attack could be a lawful act of war. And this kind of attack would probably be a violation of the right to life or the right to health or a number of other human rights. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that, unlike IHL, individuals can take cases to the different human rights courts and bodies and for example, claim compensation. So there is more mechanisms in the human rights world than it is in the IHL world to use for that kind of purposes. So So none of the legal areas that I've mentioned so far deals specifically with nuclear weapons. This here is a number of specific armed treaties that I'm just putting up to place the recent treaty in its context, legally speaking. All of these treaties have been based on the main rules and principle of international humanitarian law that I mentioned. For example, the first two or three or even four of these treaties were based on the rule on a prohibition against unnecessary suffering for soldiers. Exploding ammunition and expanding bullets were certainly so, and also the gas protocols were based on the sufferings of soldiers, mainly. Then the biological weapons ban, of course, is maybe the most the foremost example of a weapon that cannot arguably distinguish between civilians and military. These are diseases. So that is obviously based in the principle or the rule on distinction. ENMOD is a prohibition on environmental modification techniques, which came after the Vietnam War, where pesticides had been used to remove vegetation as to expose Viet Cong fighters. And still, Vietnam suffers from these use of pesticides in large areas. Then we have the CCW, which is the UN Convention on Certain Inhumane Weapons, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Or I'll come back to it later today, actually. But that is very closely linked to both the distinction rule and the excessive injury rule. The chemical weapons ban, of course, again, distinction, unnecessary suffering. Antipersonal landmines, distinction, obviously, was civilians were dying from mines long after the fighting had gone. The same with cluster munitions. And now the nuclear weapons ban, which will be discussed later today by Bonnie from Harvard, which is obviously also based in both the distinction rule and proportionality rule and the unnecessary suffering rule. So this is the sort of body of law which is tradition in which the nuclear weapons ban places itself. All of these treaties contain various elements. They're not exactly the same, but most of them contain prohibitions on the use of these weapons, but not all of them, not the CCW. So that contains regulations on use. Many of them contain disarmament obligations, including stockpile destruction obligations. Some of them have provisions on clearing of explosive remnants, the anti-personnel mine and the cluster munition conventions. And most of them have non-proliferation provisions, including prohibitions on transfer and export. So now I'm coming to the treaties that pertain specifically to nuclear weapons. And there are not that many, but there are actually many if you count the nuclear weapon-free zones. There are two treaties on testing. There are a number of treaties on nuclear weapon-free zones. And then there is the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which I will talk about in some more detail. Now, if we look at testing, many people are surprised by the number of nuclear explosions that have taken place since 1945. It's actually more than 2,000. And many of those have had severe health effects, particularly, of course, from the atmospheric testing. I don't know if some of you heard Thurlow's speech yesterday in the Oslo City Hall, where she was mentioning places like Mururoa, Bikini, etc. This is what she was referring to, the testing in the Pacific and other places, which led to very many people's ruin. So this, of course, was recognized as a problem, and therefore in 1963, we had the PTBT, the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which prohibits atmospheric and underwater testing, but not underground testing. Then in 1996, we had the CTBT, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which prohibits all testing. It has very many ratifying states, as you can see, but it is not in force. And this is quite important because this means it is not actually a part of the body of international law as treaty, because the US and Russia has refused to ratify it, and therefore it cannot enter into force. However, the number of countries that have ratified the treaty indicates that customary law is strong here, and I think it's safe to say that customary law bans testing in the atmosphere and in space and underwater, but still it's not completely certain how the legal situation with regard to underground testing. Nuclear weapon-free zones are also sort of not so much discussed legal area, but it's quite significant. There are two different kinds of nuclear weapon-free zones. One is the uninhibited areas, such as Antarctica, outer space, the moon, and the seabed. These are all treaties which prohibit a lot of things, including testing. Then it's the regional nuclear weapon-free zones. And there are a number of those. There is one for Latin America, one for the Pacific, one for Southeast Asia, one for Africa, and Central Asia and Mongolia. And then Austria has a national moratorium on nuclear weapons, and it's not recognized by the UN as a nuclear weapon-free zone, but in fact it is. There is a long time discussion going on a WMD free zone in the Middle East, and it's called a weapons of mass destruction free zone. This has to do with the fact that Egypt has refused to sign up to the chemical weapons conventions for as long as Israel keeps their nuclear weapons. So it's a kind of a deadlock. It will not be solved until the situation in the Middle East will be solved, I think. But it keeps coming up at meetings and so on. Now all of these treaties prohibit production, storage, testing, receipt, use, stationing, etc. A number of things. They are slightly different, but they're sort of built over the same kind of framework. More than 100 states are in one of these treaties, and geographically, they're covering a total of 50% of the Earth's surface, and I think 90% of the southern hemisphere. So these are very significant treaties, and they, of course, have contributed to the fact that so many states from the south participated in the ban on nuclear weapons this summer. Now we come to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. So already in 1945, discussions on prohibition on nuclear weapons started. And in the 60s, there was a lot of public pressure going on, particularly in Western countries, on nuclear weapons. I can actually remember it myself as a kid, that I was afraid of nuclear weapons. In the 60s, the sort of discussions really got going. As you can see, John F. Kennedy made this statement as early as 1961. I'm not going to go into the history of negotiations of the NPT, but it was adopted in 1968, and it had been then subject to negotiations for many years. It started off with bilateral negotiations between the US and the Soviet Union. But there were a lot of non-nuclear weapon states that were concerned with these issues that were being discussed in the negotiations. Many states had ambitions on developing their own nuclear weapons programs. Actually, it was discussed in Norway and Sweden as well. This was seen as probably a smart thing back then by many countries. And so this was one of the reasons why the group of states was expanded, that the US and the Soviet Union probably realized that it was a good idea to include some more states in the non-proliferation treaty in order to make it an actual non-proliferation instrument that would work. So in the end, it was 18 states that negotiated the NPT. And the point of departure then was that the obligations under the NPT would be carried out within 25 years. if we look at the content of the NPT, it is kind of as an example of international law. It is not really mainstream for a number of reasons. First of all, because it divides its state parties into two different categories, which is not usual under international law. International law normally does the opposite. It makes sure that everybody has the same rights and same obligations. But it divides the states into the nuclear weapon states, and that was those states who had tested a nuclear weapon before 1967. And then all of the rest are the non-nuclear weapon states who had not tested a nuclear weapon in 1967. And of course, as you all know, the first category happens to be the same states as the five veto powers in the Security Council. Of course, had to do with the whole structure of the UN and the Security Council. It has three main pillars, which is non-proliferation, which was the main aim of the negotiations. Then it has a pillar on peaceful use of nuclear weapons, which was very important to many states. And thirdly, it has a disarmament pillar. And I'll come back to these. The non-proliferation obligation and pillar is laid down in these two first articles. The first article says that all the nuclear weapon states are obliged not to transfer to any recipient nuclear weapons or control of nuclear weapons to anyone. And the second article is the obligation on the non-nuclear weapon states, which says that all non-nuclear weapon states are obliged not to manufacture or otherwise acquire nuclear weapons. So that's sort of the way that the non-proliferation regime works. It has been a lot of discussion about the term transfer in Article 1 because, as you know, the US has in fact transferred nuclear weapons to non-nuclear weapon states in the context of NATO. We know that there are nuclear weapons in the Netherlands, in Germany, other places, and so they must have been transferred. But in fact, this was a sort of implicit agreement during the negotiations at the time between the Soviet Union and the US that this would be an understanding that it would be legal or at least accepted that NATO had this possibility to place nuclear weapons outside of the US and the UK and France. But that is a sort of a big debate still going on. Then we have the provision on peaceful use. First of all, there is an obligation for all states to join the IAEA's control regimes, particularly with regard to export control. This is a very complicated and expansive regime that all states are, or more or less all states are party to. Article 4 says that all states have the right to develop and use nuclear power for peaceful use, so the NPT doesn't do anything with nuclear power. And then Article 5, which is maybe the most curious article, is on peaceful nuclear explosions and the right of non-nuclear states to benefit from this. And that was actually because during this time there were programs, there was the idea that one could make, for example, the second Panama Canal with nuclear explosions. And I don't know if you've seen Bruce Willis stopping a comet with a nuclear device in one movie, for example. So there was actually the time when one thought that nuclear explosions could be used for productive things. But of course, it's not very relevant anymore. Then we come to the famous Article 6, disarmament. And Article 6 says that all states' parties are obliged to pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to the cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date and to nuclear disarmament. And this sentence is really the basis for the new Prohibition Treaty. The new prohibition treaty may be defined as an effective measure leading to nuclear disarmament, for example. So, but if you look at it, it is not a very sort of hard law kind of obligation. It's not an obligation outlining a specific result, but it is an obligation to work for the negotiations for nuclear disarmament. This came very late in the negotiations, and the US and the Soviet Union did not want it. They wanted to exclude it, but others, such as Sweden and Mexico, worked really hard to get it into the treaty, and the compromise was that text from the preamble was taken into the treaty itself, and that was maybe one of the reasons why it is not a very strong specific obligation. It was watered down as much as possible by the nuclear weapon states, but still it's there, and it is a legal obligation, and it is obviously the basis for the new treaty. So the NPT was called the grand bargain. Article 2, which says that everyone else than the nuclear weapon states are not to acquire nuclear weapons. So they forewent their rights or their possibilities to establish nuclear weapon programs in exchange for the commitment by the nuclear weapon states that they would disarm, or that they would at least start working for disarmament, which is the final goal of the NPT. If you look in the preamble, it says very clearly that the NPT's final goal is to eliminate nuclear weapons. So this was the bargain. The question, of course, is it still a bargain? Does it work? If we look at the NPT's implementation system, it has a review conference every 5 years. And the meaning with these conferences is that one should agree on a final document at each of these conferences on measures relating to the implementation of the treaty. This is pretty normal procedure for treaties. At the 2010 review conference, there was an agreement on a plan of action with 22 specific points on disarmament and on Article 6. Of course, the process in the NPT is based on consensus, so everybody has to agree to everything. So the nuclear weapon states were on board with this plan of action. Only 5 of these have been fulfilled to date, and they are not very operative. At the next review conference in 2015, there was no agreement at all on final document. So what takes place in the NPT is not very encouraging, to say the least. So if you look at the NPT, what are the weaknesses? Well, even if the disarmament obligation is vague, it is a legally binding provision, but there is very little effort to adhere to it from the nuclear weapon states side. And they are very openly admitting this, in a way. I mean, they are sort of saying in meetings. I went to the first committee last year, and I heard statements, for example, by France, telling, you know, the great big powers like Indonesia and South Africa and Mexico and others that, you know, go and play. You know, we are the adults here. You don't understand. This is the real world. Very condescending manner of speaking in those meetings. And that, of course, annoys states no end, and is one of the reasons why the new treaty has come about, I should say. Another weakness is that not all states are party. India and Pakistan and Israel has never joined the treaty, and it is legal to withdraw from it, which North Korea did. If you claim that it's against your national interests to be part of the NPT, you can withdraw from it. And there is no legal sanctions against not being a party. So there is actually less consequences for countries like India and Pakistan and North Korea as well than it is for Iran, who is a party. So it's kind of, you know, it's not a very strong strong regime in that sense. But I think the biggest weakness with the NPT is that it does not set a common norm regarding nuclear weapons. It doesn't prohibit the use of nuclear weapons. On the contrary, of course, it presupposes use. Otherwise, deterrence doesn't mean anything. So it has to be understood that the NPT allows for use by the nuclear weapon states. And it creates a universal but very asymmetrical system based on what I called earlier a very condescending logic. The nuclear weapon states claim that nuclear weapons are necessary for their safety while at the same time denying other states the same safety. So it's one of the logics under the NPT which has made, I think, paved the way for the new treaty negotiations. Having said that, it's important to note that the NPT is a non-proliferation success, definitely. It has been very successful. Only three states have remained outside and one has withdrawn, but apart from that, the rest of the non-nuclear weapon states have stuck to their part of the bargain, and we would have had surely 20, 30, 40 nuclear weapon states today if it hadn't been for the NPT. So one has to realize that this is very important to keep. The disarmament element has not been successful. We keep hearing from government officials that we must keep the disarmament efforts within the framework of the NPT. Well, not one nuclear weapons has been disarmed in the context of the NPT. This is not what the NPT does. And of course, the patience regarding the disarmament is wearing very thin after 40 years after the 1995 deadline. So I would say that there is a risk that the lack of disarmament efforts will undermine the non-proliferation obligations in the treaty and will undermine the treaty, which is a much greater risk than the new treaty undermining the NPT. There is no reason why the new treaty should undermine the NPT, but the lack of taking on the disarmament obligations actually is a possible way of undermining it. So why should the non-nuclear weapon states stick to their end of the bargain when the nuclear weapon states do not stick to theirs? All right. Very briefly, on regional defense alliances, also called nuclear umbrellas. This is just because this is coming up a lot in the discussions now from people who are worried about the new prohibition treaty. We have a lot of regional defense alliances where NATO, of course, is the most prominent one. You have the ANSYS, you have the US and Japan, you have also a mutual defense treaty between US and South Korea, and you have the CSTO, which is a collective security treaty organization with Russia and a number of their neighboring states. All of these are international treaties, but none of them deal with nuclear weapons, but they're still often referred to as nuclear umbrellas. Let us just take a brief look at what nuclear umbrellas are. They are security arrangements whereby states agree to either protect or to be protected by the use of nuclear weapons. And NATO is the most prominent, but also the Japan, South Korea, Australia are nuclear umbrellas, and then Belarus is another example of being under a nuclear umbrella. But all of these nuclear umbrellas are based on security treaties, but none of these treaties mention nuclear weapons. What does mention nuclear weapons, however, is NATO's strategic concept. But it's important to know that this is not a legal document. This is a political document. And it does say two things which may seem conflicting. It says that NATO will remain a nuclear alliance as long as there are nuclear weapons. And at the same time, it says that NATO is committed to creating conditions for a world without nuclear weapons. So it has been a point for the skeptics of the new treaty to say that it is inconsistent with legal obligations in the NATO. This is not correct. There is no legal reason why Norway or others couldn't join the new treaty, but it is without a doubt politically very difficult. That is, and Norway would have to leave the nuclear planning group, and there would be a lot of difficulties, probably, or very, very likely. But legally speaking, it is not actually true that this is a problem as such. All right. So I'm almost there. Summing up, there is no legal vacuum for nuclear weapons, as I've shown you, even before the Bern Treaty. There are a lot of indirect regulations that I've looked at, some of them now, and there are also a lot of direct regulations. But there was one very significant legal gap, and that was that there was no prohibition on the use of nuclear weapons. The most destructive, without a doubt, of the three weapons of mass destruction, there was not a prohibition of use, which it was for biological and chemical weapons. And this gap has now been filled with the new prohibition treaty. Thank you.
We listen to a lecture of Dr. Jur Gro Nystuen about nuclear weapons under international law from 1949 to 2017. Vi hørte her en forelæsning af Dr. Jur Gro Nystuen om atomvåben under international lov fra 1949 til 2017. Optagelsen er fra den 11. december 2017 i Oslo i anledning af Nobels fredsprisuddeling til ICAN. Og det er altså den første af fem juridiske forelæsninger omkring traktaten med forbud mod atomvåben i forhold til international lov. Indslaget her er optaget af dialog på Frederikshavn Lokalradio og kan til enhver tid genhøres på netadressen www.arnehansen.net/dialog. Og her søger man så i browseren på folkeretten og det nye forbud mod atomvåben.